The cold of the desert night eventually forced Arlen to take his eyes off the metal spear. He had laid a fire when he made camp earlier, so he struck spark to it and coaxed the flames to life, warming himself and a bite of dinner. Dawnrunner was hobbled and blanketed in his circle, brushed and fed before Arlen left to explore the ruins that afternoon. As it had every night for the last 3 years, one arm showed up soon after moonrise, bounding over the dunes and scattering the smaller corals to stand before Arlen's circle. Arlen greeted it, as always, with a clap of his two hands. When he first left Milne, Arlen had wondered if he would ever find a way to sleep through the sound of one arm hammering at his wards. But it was second nature to him now. His warding circle had been proven time and again, and Arlen maintained it religiously, keeping the plates freshly lacquered and the rope mended. He hated the demon, though. The years had brought none of the kinship the guards on the wall of Fort Milne had felt. As one arm remembered who had crippled it, so too did Arlen recall who had given him the puckered scars across his back and almost cost him his life. He remembered, too, 9 warders, 37 guardsmen, 2 messengers, 3 herb gatherers, and 18 citizens of Milne who had lost their lives because of it. He gazed at the demon now, absently stroking his new spear. What would happen if he struck? The weapon had wounded a sand demon. Would the wards affect a rock demon as well? It took all his willpower to resist the urge to leap from his circle and find out. Arlen had hardly slept when the sun drove the demons back into the core, but he rose with high spirits. After breakfast, he took out his notebook and examined the spear, painstakingly copying every ward and studying the patterns they formed along the shaft and head. When he finished, the sun was high in the sky. Taking another torch, he went back down into the catacombs, making rubbings of the wards cut into the stone. There were other tombs, and he was tempted to ignore all scents and explore every one. But if he stayed even another day, his food would run out before he reached the Oasis of Dawn. He had gambled on finding a well in the ruins of Anak's Sun, and indeed he had, but vegetation was scant and inedible. The ruins had stood for centuries. They would be there when he returned, hopefully with a team of Krasian warders at his back. By the time he came back outside, the day was wearing on. Arlen took time to exercise and feed Dawnrunner, then prepared a meal for himself, his mind turned inwards. The Krasians would demand proof, of course. Proof the spear could kill. They were warriors, not ruin hunters, and would not give up a single able-bodied man for an expedition without good reason. Proof. And it was only right that it come from him. With barely an hour before sunset, Arlen began to ready his camp. He hobbled his horse again, checking the portable circle around it. He prepared his 10-foot circle as usual, then took a series of ward stones from his bags and began to lay them around it in a wide outer ring some 40 feet in diameter. He placed the stones slightly farther apart than usual, carefully lining them up with their fellows. There was a third portable circle in the saddlebags. Arlen always kept a spare, and he set that one in the camp as well, off to the side in the larger circle by its edge. When he was finished, Arlen knelt in his center circle, the spear at his side, clearing his mind of distractions. He didn't watch as the sun dipped and the sand glowed on the horizon before going dark. The nimble sand demons rose first. Moments later, he heard the roar of one arm. Magic flared, visible even through his closed eyelids. But the demon did not immediately continue its assault. He opened his eyes, watching one arm cock its head curiously. One arm struck the wards again. And again, it paused. This time, it set its feet, thrusting its good arm at the warrior, talons spread. Like it was pressing against a wall of glass, the demon leaned forward. Angry magic spiderwebbed out from where its claws met the barrier, and as the demon pressed, the magic bowed visibly in the air. The rock demon flexed its armored legs and smashed through the ward net, tumbling into the inner ring. Dawnrunner pulled at his hobble. Arlen rose as one arm did, their eyes meeting. Though he had grown since they had first met, Arlen felt no less dwarfed by one arm now than he had that first terrifying night. The rock demon stood over 15 feet tall, from its clawed feet to the tips of its horns, more than twice a man's height. Arlen was forced to crane his head upwards to meet the Corling's eyes, locked unwaveringly on his own. One arm's snout split wide to reveal rows of razor-sharp teeth running with drool, and it flexed its dagger-like talons teasingly. Its armored chest was thrown out, the black carapace impenetrable to known weapons, and its spiked tail whipped back and forth, heavy enough to smash a horse with a single blow. Its body was smoking and scorched from crossing the neck, but the obvious hurt only made the Corling seem more dangerous, a titan mad with pain. Arlen's fingers tightened on the metal spear as he stepped from the circle. Arlen's feet slowly slid apart into a battle stance. He felt as if his entire life had been rushing towards this moment without him ever realizing it. He wasn't sure if he was ready for this test, but after being hounded by this demon for over 10 years, the thought of putting it off for any longer was intolerable. Even now, he could step back into the protective circle, safe from the rock demon's attacks. Deliberately, he moved away from it, committing himself to the contest. He would either die here, or he would prove his right to be free. One arm watched him circle, its muzzle curling in a snarl. The demon lunged, its talons splayed as they cut the air. Arlen darted straight forward, ducking the blow and moving inside the Corling's reach. He kept on, moving right between its legs, stabbing his spear into its tail as he rolled aside. There was a satisfying flash of magic as he struck, and the weapon pierced its armor and struck flesh. Arlen was expecting the return slash of the demon's tail, but it came quicker than he anticipated. He threw himself on the ground as the appendage whooshed by, the spikes inches from his head. He was up again in a flash, but one arm was already turning, using its tail's momentum to speed its pivot. One arm struck again, and Arlen could not dodge in time. But as the demon's talons struck the metal of the spear, the wards etched along its length flare. Arlen hardly felt the blow, but one arm was deflected as if it had struck a warded circle. The demon was thrown back as its own power rebounded, but it recovered fast, unharmed. Scattering sand as he ran, Arlen vaulted the fallen remains of a thick stone pillar, taking shelter behind it and preparing to dodge left or right, depending on how the demon approached. One arm struck hard at the pillar. Arlen bolted for his circle, needing a moment to recover. The demon anticipated his reaction, though, and its legs twitched, launching it into the air. It landed in between Arlen and his sucker. Arlen stopped short. It had tested Arlen's mettle and found him wanting. It respected the spear's bite, but there was no fear in the Corling's eyes as it advanced. Arlen gave ground slowly, deliberately, not wanting to provoke the creature with a sudden move. He backed up as far as he could before crossing his outer ward stones and coming into the reach of the sand demons clustered to watch the battle. Arlen set himself firmly, his legs coiled. He did not bother to raise the spear to block. Instead, he cocked it back, ready to stab. Arlen had allowed the demon to back it into his spare portable circle, unnoticed in the sand, and Arlen was ready, leaping forward and skewering the demon in the belly with his warded spear. He pulled back on the spear, but it held fast, caught in the rock demon's thick black carapace. He yanked again, and this time it nearly cost him his life as one arm lashed out and struck him a glancing blow, its claws digging deep into his shoulder and chest. Arlen was sent spinning away, but he wrenched himself towards his spare circle, collapsing in the protective ring. As he clutched his wounds, he watched the giant rock demon stumble about. Again and again, one arm attempted to grasp the spear and pull it free of the wound, but the wards along its length thwarted the demon. And all along, the magic continued to work, sparking in the wound and sending killing waves through the Corling's body. Arlen allowed himself a slight smile as one arm collapsed to the ground, thrashing. But as he watched the demon's flailing slow to twitching, he felt a great emptiness grow inside of him. He had dreamt of this moment countless times, of how it would feel, of what he would say, but it wasn't like he imagined. Instead of elation, he felt depression and loss.
That was for you, Mom.
Arlen tried to picture her, desperate to feel her approval, and he was shocked and ashamed when he could not remember her face. Giving the demon a wide berth, Arlen made his way back to his supplies, binding his wounds. The stitches he made were crooked, but they held his wounds closed, and the hog root poultice burned, the pain evidence of its need. Already, the wound was infecting. He found no sleep that night. If the pain of his wounds and the ache of his heart had not been sufficient to drive slumber away, a chapter of his life was about to end, and he was determined to see it through. When the sun crested the dunes, it flooded Arlen's camp with a speed that could only be found in the desert. The sand demons had already melted away, fleeing at the first hint of dawn. Arlen stood up, making his way from the circle to stand over one arm, retrieving his spear as the light struck its massive armored form. Wherever the light touched, the black carapace smoked, then sparked and ignited. Soon the demon's body was a funeral pyre, and Arlen stood watching, mesmerized. As the rock demon collapsed into ashes, soon borne on the morning wind, he saw hope for the human race. The desert road wasn't really a road at all, simply a string of ancient signposts, some clawed and jagged, others half buried in wind, keeping a traveler from losing their way. It wasn't all sand, as Reagan had once said, though there was enough of that to wander for days seeing naught else. On the outskirts ran hundreds of miles of hard, dust-choked flats, with sparse bits of dead vegetation clinging to cracked clay, too dry to rot. Apart from the shadows cast by dunes in the sea of sand, there was no shelter from the beating sun. So hot, Arlen could not imagine it was the same body that brought cold light to Fort Milne. The wind blew continually, and he had to cover his face to keep from inhaling sand, his throat raw and dry. The nights were worse. The heat leaching from the ground moments after the sun dipped below the horizon, welcoming the Corlings into a cold, desolate place. But even here, there was life. Snakes and lizards hunted tiny rodents. Carrion birds sought the corpses of creatures slain by Corlings, or that wandered into the desert and could not find their way back out. There were at least two large oases, where a large body of water caused the surrounding soil to grow dense with edible vegetation, and others where a trickle from the rock or a pool of water no wider than a man's stride supported a host of stunted plants and small creatures. Arlen had witnessed these desert dwellers burying themselves in the sand at night, resisting the cold with conserved heat, and hiding from the demons that stalked the sands. There were no rock demons in the desert, for there was not enough prey. No flame demons, because there was little to burn. Wood demons had no bark to blend into, no limbs to climb. Water demons could not swim through sand, and wind demons could find no perch. The dunes and desert flats belonged to sand demons alone. Even they were sparse in the deep desert, clustering mostly about the oases, but the sight of a fire would draw them from miles around. 5 weeks from Fort Risen to Crasia, more than half of it through the desert, was more than many of the hardiest messengers cared to contemplate. Despite northern merchants offering exorbitant sums for Crasian silks and spice, few were desperate or crazy enough to go there. For his own part, Arlen found the trip peaceful. He slept in his saddle during the hottest parts of the day, carefully wrapped in loose white cloth. He watered his horse frequently and spread tarps beneath his portable circles at night to keep the wards from becoming obscured in the sand. He was tempted to lash out at the circling sand demons, but his wound had made his grip weak. And he knew that should the spear be pulled from his grasp, a common wind might lose it in the sand more surely than hundreds of years in a buried tomb. Despite the cries of the sand demons, the nights seemed quiet to Arlen, used to the great roars of one arm. He slept more peacefully on those nights than any spent outside before. For the first time in his life, Arlen saw his path extend beyond being a glorified errand boy. He had always known he was destined for more than messaging. He was destined to fight. But he now realized it was more than that. He was destined to bring others to fight. He was certain he could duplicate the warded spear and was already pondering ways to adapt its wards to other weapons. Arrows, staves, sling stones, the possibilities were endless. In all the places he had seen, only the Kraysians refused to live in terror of the Gorlings, and for that reason, Arlen respected them above all. There were no people more deserving of this gift. He would show them the spear, and they would supply him with everything he needed to build them weapons to turn the tide of their nightly war. The thoughts fled as Arlen caught sight of the oasis. The sand could reflect the blue sky and trick a man into rushing off the road to water that did not exist. But when his horse picked up the pace, Arlen knew it was real. Dawn Runner could smell the water. Their water had been depleted the day before, and by the time they reached the small pool, both Arlen and his horse were sick with thirst. In unison, they dropped their heads to the cool water, drinking deeply. When they had drunk their fill, Arlen refilled their water skins and set them in the shade beneath one of the sandstone monoliths, standing silent guard around the oasis. He inspected the wards cut into the stone, finding them intact, but with some signs of wear. The eternally blowing sand scratched at them little by little, wearing down the edges over time. He took out his etching tools, deepening and sharpening them to maintain the net. While Dawn Runner grazed on scrub grass and the leaves of stunted bushes, Arlen harvested dates, figs, and other fruit from the oasis trees. He ate his fill and set the rest where they could dry in the sun. An underground river fed the oasis, and in years beyond memory, men had dug away the sand and cut the stone beneath, finally reaching the running water. Arlen descended the stone steps into a cool underground chamber and collected the nets stored there, tossing them into the water. When he left the room, he carried a satisfying catch of fish. He set aside a choice few for himself and cleaned the others, salting them and setting them alongside the fruit to dry. Taking a forked tool from the oasis stores, he then searched around the stones, at last spotting telltale grooves in the sand. Soon he had a snake pinned with the forked stick and snatched it by the tail, cracking it like a whip to kill it. There was likely a cache of eggs nearby, but he did not search them out. It would be dishonorable to deplete the oasis more than necessary. Again, he put part of the snake aside for his own uses and set the rest to dry. In a carved nook in one of the great sandstones, marked with the sigils of many messengers, Arlen retrieved a cache of tough, dried fruits, fish, and meat left by the previous messenger and refilled his saddlebags. Once his harvest dried, he would replenish the nook for the next messenger to succor here. It was impossible to cross the desert without stopping at the Oasis of Dawn. The only source of water for over 100 miles, it was the destination of every desert traveler in either direction. Most of these were messengers, and therefore warders, and over many years, that exclusive society had marked their passing on the abundant sandstone. Dozens of names were cut into the stones. Some were simply scratched print, while others were masterworks of calligraphy. Many messengers included more than just their names, listing the cities they had visited, or the number of times they had succored at the Oasis of Dawn. On his 11th trip through the oasis, Arlen had long since finished carving his name and those of the living cities and villages he had visited. But he never stopped exploring and always had something to add. Slowly, using beautiful scrolling letters, Arlen reverently inscribed Anuk's son into the list of ruins he had seen. That no other messenger's mark in the oasis made such a claim filled him with pride. The next day, Arlen continued to increase the oasis stores. It was a matter of honor among messengers to leave the oasis stocked better than it was found, against the day when one of their number should stumble in too injured or sunstruck to gather for themselves. Arlen left the Oasis of Dawn first thing the next morning, heading southwest. For 5 days, he saw little more than yellow dunes and sand demons, but early on the 6th, the city of Fort Krasia, the Desert Spear, came into view, framed by the mountains beyond. From afar, it seemed just another dune, sandstone walls blending with their surroundings. It was built around an oasis much larger than the Oasis of Dawn, fed, the ancient maps said, by the same great underground river. Its warded walls, carved rather than painted, stood proudly in the sun. High above the city flew Krasia's crossed spears over a rising sun. The guards at the gate wore the black robes of Dal Sharom, the Krasian warrior caste, veiled against the ruthless sand. While not as tall as Milnese, Krasians were a head taller than most Angerians or Lactonians, hard with wiry muscle. Arlen nodded to them as he passed. The guards raised their spears in return. Among Krasian men, this was the barest courtesy, but Arlen had worked hard to earn the gesture. In Krasia, a man was judged by the number of scars he carried and alagai, Korlings, he had killed. Outsiders, or kin, as the Krasians called them, even messengers, were considered cowards who had given up the fight and were unworthy of any courtesy from Dal Sharom. The word kin was an insult. But Arlen had shocked the Kratians with his request to fight alongside them. And after teaching their warriors new wards and assisting in many kills, they now called him Parkin, which meant brave outsider. He would never be considered an equal, but the Dal Shuram had stopped spitting at his feet, and he had even made a few true friends. Through the gate, Arlen entered the maze, a wide inner yard before the wall of the city proper, filled with walls, trenches, and pits. Each night, their families locked safe behind the inner walls, the Dal Shuram engaged in Alagai Shirak, holy war against demonkind. They lured Korlings into the maze, ambushing and harrying them into warded pits to await the sun. Casualties were high, but Kratians believed that dying in Alagai Shirak assured them a place at the side of Everim, the creator, and went gladly into the killing zone.
Soon, it will be only Korlings that die here.
Just inside the main gate was the Great Bazaar, where merchants hawked over hundreds of laden carts, the air thick with hot Kratian spices, incense, and exotic perfumes. Rugs, bolts of fine cloth, and beautiful painted pottery sat beside mounds of fruit and bleating livestock. Jewelry and bright cloth was sold in abundance in the bazaar, but Arlen had never seen it worn. Men had told him that women wore the adornments under their black, but only their husbands knew for sure. Kratian men above the age of 13 were almost all warriors. A small few were Dama, the holy men, who were also Kratia's secular leaders. No other vocation was considered honorable. Those who took a craft were called kafit and considered contemptible, barely above women in Kratian society. The women did all the day-to-day work in the city, from farming and cooking to childcare. They dug clay and made pottery, built and repaired homes, trained and slaughtered animals, and haggled in the markets. In short, they did everything but fight. Yet despite their unending labor, they were utterly subservient to the men. A man's wives and unmarried daughters were his property, and he could do with them as he pleased, even kill them. A man could take many wives, but if a woman so much as let a man who was not her husband look at her unveiled, she could and often would be put to death. Kratian women were considered expendable. Men were not. Without their women, Arlen knew, the Kratian men would be lost. But the women treated men in general with reverence, and their husbands with near worship. They came each morning to find the dead from the night's Alagai Shirak and wailed over the bodies of their men, collecting their precious tears in tiny vials. Water was coin in Kratia, and a warrior's status in life could be measured by the number of tear bottles filled upon his death. If a man were killed, it was expected that his brothers or friends would take his wives, so they would always have a man to serve. Following behind almost every woman were several tan-clad children, the girls' hair wrapped, the boys in rag caps. As early as 11, the girls would begin to marry and take on the black clothes of women, while the boys would be taken to the training grounds. Most of them would take on the black robes of Dai Shuram. Some few would come to wear the white Dama and devote their lives to serving Everim. Those who failed at both professions would be kafit and wear tan in shame until they died. The women caught sight of Arlen as he rode through the market and began whispering to one another excitedly. He watched them, amused, for none would look him in the eye or approach him. They hungered for the goods in his saddlebags, fine Rizonian wool, Milanese jewels, Angerian paper, and other treasures of the north. But he was a man, and worse, a kin, and they dared not approach. The eyes of the Dama were everywhere.
Harkin!
Arlen turned to see his friend Abin approach, the fat merchant limping and leaning heavily on his crutch. Lame since childhood, Abin was kafit, unable to stand amongst the warriors, and unworthy to be a holy man. He had done well for himself, though, doing trade with messengers from the north. He was clean-shaven and wore the tan cap and shirt of kafit, but over that he wore a rich headcloth, vest, and pantaloons of bright silk, stitched in many colors. He claimed his wives were as beautiful as those of any Dal Shuram.
By Everim, it is good to see you, son of Jeff. The sun always shines brighter when you grace our city.
Arlen wished he had never told the merchant his father's name. In Kratia, the name of a man's father was more important than one's own. He wondered what they would think if they knew his father was a coward. But he clapped Abin on the shoulder in return, his smile genuine.
And you, my friend.
Come, come. Rest your feet in my shade and wash the dust from your throat with my water.
Abin led Arlen to a bright and colorful tent pitched behind his carts in the bazaar. He clapped his hands, and his wives and daughters, Arlen could never tell the difference, scurried to open the flaps and tend to Dawn Runner. The inside of the tent was filled with colorful silk pillows and intricately woven carpets. Arlen left his dusty boots by the flap and breathed deeply of the cool, scented air. He eased down onto the pillows on the floor as Abin's women knelt before him with water and fruit.
Your trip through the desert passed well?
Oh, yes. Very well indeed.
They made small talk for some time afterwards. Abin never failed in this formality, but his eyes kept flicking to Arlen's saddlebags, and he rubbed his hands together absently.
Ah, to business then.
Of course. The Partin is a busy man.
The women quickly brought out an array of spices, perfume, silks, jewelry, rugs, and other Krasian craft. Abin examined the goods from Arlen's clients in the north, while Arlen perused the items proposed for trade. Abin found fault with everything, scowling.
Ugh! You crossed the desert just to trade this lot? It hardly seems worth the trip.
Arlen hid his grin as they sat and were served fresh tea. Bidding always started this way.
Nonsense. A blind man could see I've brought some of the finest treasures Thesa has to offer. Better by far than the sorry goods your women have brought before me. I hope you have more hidden away, because I've seen better carpets rotting in ruins.
You wound me! I, who give you water and shade! Who am I, that a guest in my tent should treat me so? My wives work the loom day and night to make that, using only the finest wool. A better carpet you'll never see.
After that, it was only a matter of haggling, and Arlen had not forgotten the lessons learned watching Old Hog and Reagan a lifetime ago. As always, the session ended with both men acting as if they had been robbed, but inwardly feeling they had gotten the better of the other.
My daughters will pack up your goods and hold them for your departure. Will you sup with us tonight? My wives prepare a table none in your north can match.
I go to fight tonight.
I fear you have learned our ways too well, Partin. You seek the same death.
I have no intent to die, and expect no paradise in the next life.
Ah, my friend. No one intends to go to Evrim in the flower of their youth. But that is the fate that awaits those who go to Alagai Sharak. I can recall a time when there are as many of us as there are grains of sand in the desert. But now, the city is practically empty. We keep the bellies of our wives fat with children, but still more die in the night than are born in the day. If we don't change our ways, a decade from now, Krasia will be consumed by the sand.
What if I told you I'd come to change that?
This son of Jeff's heart is true, but the Damaji will not listen to you. Evrim demands war, they say, and no kin is going to change their minds.
The Damaji were the city's ruling council, made up of the highest-ranked Dama of each of the 12 Krasian tribes. They served the Andra, Evrim's most favored Dama, whose word was absolute.
I can't turn them from Alagai Sharak, but I can help them win it.
Arlen uncovered his spear and held it out to Abin. Abin's eyes widened slightly at the sight of the magnificent weapon, but he raised his palm and shook his head.
I am Kafit, Parkin. The spear is forbidden to my unclean touch.
I meant no offense.
You may be the only man ever to bow to me. Even the Parkin need not fear offending Kafit.
You are a man like any other.
With that attitude, you will ever begin. You're not the first man to ward a spear. Without the combat wards of old, it makes no difference.
They are the wards of old. I found this in the ruins of Anaxun.
You found the lost city? The map was accurate?
Why do you sound so surprised? I thought you said it was guaranteed.
Well, I trusted my source, of course. But no one has been there in more than 300 years. Who is to say how accurate the map was? Besides, it's not like you were likely to come back for a refund if I was wrong.
Arlen went on to describe his adventure in the lost city.
By Evrim. It is a fine tale, Parkin. But if you value your life, you will not tell the Damaji that you looted the holy city of Anaxun.
I won't. But surely they'll see the value in the spear, regardless.
Even if they agree to grant you audience, Parkin, and I doubt they will refuse to see value in anything a king brings them.
You might be right, but I should at least try. I have messages to deliver to the Andras Palace anyway. Walk with me.
It is a long way to the palace, Parkin.
I'll walk slowly.
You don't want to be seen with me outside the market, my friend. That alone may cost you the respect you've earned in the maze.
Then I'll earn more. What good is respect if I can't walk with my friend?
One day, I wish to see the land that makes noble men like the son of Jeff.
When that day comes, Aban, I will take you across the desert myself.
Aban grabbed Arlen's arm.
Stop walking!
Arlen obeyed, trusting in his friend, though he saw nothing amiss. Women walked the street carrying heavy loads, and a group of Dal Shaaram walked ahead of them. Another group was approaching from the other direction. Each was led by a Dama in white robes.
Khajiit tribe.
Aban pointed with his chin at the warriors ahead of them.
The others are Maja. It would be best for us to wait here a bit.
Arlen squinted at the two groups. Both were clad in the same black, and their spears were simple and unadorned.
How can you tell the difference?
How can you not?
As they watched, one of the Dama called something to the other. They faced off and began to argue.
What do you suppose they're arguing about?
Always the same thing. The Khajiit Dama believe sand demons reside on the third layer of hell and wind demons on the fourth. The Maja say the opposite. The Avija is vague on the point.
The Avija was the Krasian holy canon.
What difference does that make?
Those on the lower level are furthest from Evram's sight and should be killed first.
They'll fight one another over which demons to kill first?
The Khajiit will fight the Maja over far less, Bucky.
But there will be real enemies to fight once the sun sets.
And when it does, the Khajiit and Maja will stand united. As we say, by night, my enemy becomes my brother. But sunset is still hours away.
Why is this tolerated? Can't the Andra forbid it?
The Andra is supposed to be of all tribes and none. But in truth, he will always favor the tribe he was raised from. And even if he didn't, not even he can end every blood feud in Krasia. You can't forbid men from being men.
They're acting more like children.
The Dal Shaaram know only the spear, and the Dama the Avija.
Suddenly, Arlen noticed Aban looking over his shoulder. Aban fell to one knee. He yanked on Arlen's arm to do the same.
Kneel, if you value your hide.
Arlen looked around and spotted the source of Aban's fear. A woman walked down the road, swathed in holy white.
Dama Ting.
The mysterious herb gatherers of Krasia were seldom seen. He cast his eyes down as she passed, but did not kneel. It made no difference. She took no notice of either of them, proceeding serenely towards the melee, unnoticed until she was almost upon the man. The Dama blanched when they saw her. At once, the fighting stopped, and the warriors fell over themselves to clear a path for the Dama Ting to pass. The warriors and Dama quickly dispersed in her wake, and traffic on the road resumed as if nothing out of the ordinary had happened.
Are you brave, Birkin, or mad?
Since when do men kneel to women?
Men don't kneel to Dama Ting, but Khafit and Kin do, if they are wise. Even the Dama and Dal Shaaram fear them. It's said they see the future, knowing which men will live through the night and which will die.
So what if they do?
To offend the Dama Ting is to offend fate.
We make our own fate, even if the Dama Ting can cast their bones and see them in advance.
Well, I don't envy the fate you will make if you offend one.
They resumed walking and soon reached the Andra's palace, an enormous domed structure of white stone that was likely as old as the city itself. Its wards were painted in gold and glittered in the bright sunlight that fell upon its great spires. But they had not set foot on the palace steps before Adama came rushing down to them.
Begone, Khafit!
So sorry.
I am Arlen, son of Jeff, messenger from the north known as Par Kin. I bring letters and gifts for the Andra and his ministers.
You keep poor company for one who speaks our tongue, northerner.
An angry retort came to Arlen's lips, but he bid it back.
The Birkin needed directions.
I did not ask you to speak, Khafit!
Arlen's muscles bunched, but a warning glare from his friend kept him in place. The Dama turned back as if nothing had happened.
I will take your messages.
The Duke of Ryzen asked that I deliver a gift to the Damaji personally.
Not in this life will I let a Kin and a Khafit enter the palace.
The response was disappointing, but not unexpected. Arlen had never managed to see a Damaji. He handed over his letters and packages, scowling as the Dama ascended the steps.
I am sorry to say I told you so, my friend.
They've let me in the palace grounds before.
It did not help that I was with you. But I speak true that the Damaji would not suffer an outsider in their presence, even if it was the Duke of Urizen himself. You would have been politely asked to wait, and left forgotten on some silk pillow. to lose face. Now, will you sup with me? I have a daughter, just 15 and beautiful. She would make you a good wife in the north, keeping your home for you while you travel.
You honor me, my friend, but I'm not ready to quit just yet.
No, I rather thought not. I suppose you will go to see him.
Yes.
He is no more tolerant of my presence than the Dama.
He knows your value.
He tolerates my existence because of you. The Sharom Ka has wanted lessons in the northern tongue ever since you were first allowed into the maze.
And Aban is the only man in Krasia who knows it, making him valuable to the first warrior despite being Kafit.
They headed for the training grounds, located not far from the palace. The city's center was neutral territory for all tribes, where they gathered to worship and prepare for Alagash Arak. It was late afternoon, and the camp bustled with activity. Arlen and Aban passed first through the workshops of the weaponsmiths and warders, the only crafts considered worthy of Dal Sharom. Beyond that stood the open grounds, where men trained. On the far side was the palace of the Sharom Ka and his lieutenants, the Kai Sharom. Second only to the immense palace of the Andra, this great dome housed the most honored of all, men who had proven their valor on the battlefield time and time again. There were stares and muttered curses as Aban limped by on his crutch, but none dared bear their way. Aban was under the protection of the Sharom Ka. Deep in the midst of the training grounds was a great pavilion where they found Jardir poring over plans with one of his men. Aman Asu Hoshkamin Am Jardir was the Sharom Ka of Krasia, a title that translated into Thesian as First Warrior. He was a tall man, well over 6 feet, wrapped in black cloth and wearing a white turban. In some way Arlen did not fully understand, the title Sharom Ka was a religious one as well, signified by the turban. His skin was a deep copper color, his eyes dark as his black hair, oiled back and hanging down his neck. His black beard was forked and impeccably trimmed, but there was nothing soft about the man. He moved like a raptor, swift and sure, and his wide sleeves were rolled back to reveal hard, muscular arms, crisscrossed with scars. He was not much past 30 years old. One of the pavilion guards caught sight of Arlen and Aban as they approached and bent to whisper in Jardir's ear. The first warrior turned from the chalk slate he was studying.
Parkin!
He spread his arms with a smile and rose to meet them.
Welcome back to the Desert Spear. I did not know you had returned. The Elagai will quail in fear tonight.
He turned to Aban.
What are you doing here among men, Kafit? I have not summoned you.
He's with me.
He was with you.
Aban bowed deeply and scurried off as quickly as his lame leg would allow.
I don't know why you waste your time with that Kafit, Parkin.
Where I come from, a man's worth does not end with lifting the spear.
Where you come from, Parkin, they do not lift the spear at all.
Your Thesan is much improved.
Your kin tongue is not easy, and twice as hard for needing a Kafit to practice it when you're away.
He watched Aban limp away, sneering at his bright silks.
Look at that one. He dresses like a woman.
Arlen glanced across the yard at a black-swathed woman carrying water.
I've never seen a woman dressed like that.
Only because you won't let me find you a wife to lift her veils.
I doubt the Dama would allow one of your women to marry a useless kin.
Nonsense. We have shed blood together in the maze, my brother. If I take you into my tribe, not even the Andra himself would dare protest.
I don't think I'm ready for a wife just yet.
Well, don't wait too long, or men will think you push ting.
Arlen wasn't sure what the word meant, but he nodded anyway.
How long have you been in the city, my friend?
Only a few hours. I just delivered my messages to the palace.
And already you come to offer your spear. By Everon, the Parkin must have Krasian blood in him. Walk with me.
Jardir put his arm on Arlen's shoulder and moved away from the others. Arlen knew Jardir was already trying to decide where he would best fit in the night's battle.
The Barjin lost a pit warder last night. You could fill in there.
Pit warders were among the most important of the Krasian soldiers, warding the demon pits used to trap Korlings and assuring that the wards activated after the demons fell in. It was risky work, for if the tarps used to disguise the pits didn't fall in and reveal the wards fully, there was little to prevent a sand demon from climbing out and killing the warder as he tried to uncover them. There was only one position with a higher mortality rate.
Push guard, I would prefer.
Always the most dangerous duty for you. If you are killed, who will carry our letters?
Not so dangerous this night.
Unable to contain his excitement, he unrolled his new spear, holding it up to the first warrior proudly.
A kingly weapon. But it is the warrior that wins through in the night, Parkin, not the spear. Do not put too much faith in your weapon. I have seen warriors more seasoned than you paint their spears and come to a bitter end.
I did not make it. I found it in the ruins of Anak's son.
The birthplace of the Deliverer? The spear of Kaji is a myth, Parkin. And the lost city has been reclaimed by the sands.
I've been there. I can take you there.
I am Sharum Ka of the Desert Spear, Parkin. I cannot just pack a camel and ride off into the sand looking for a city that exists only in ancient texts.
I think I will convince you when night falls.
Promise me that you will not try anything foolish. Warded spear or no, you are not the Deliverer. It would be sad to bury you.
I promise.
Good then. Come, my friend. The hour grows late. You shall sup in my palace tonight before we muster outside Sharikhora.
They supped on spiced meats, ground peas, and the paper-thin layers of bread the Krasians made by spreading wet meal on hot, polished rocks. Arlen had a place of honor next to Jardir, surrounded by Kai Sharum and served by Jardir's own wives. Arlen never understood why Jardir paid him so much respect, but after his treatment at the Andraz Palace, it was most welcome. The men begged stories of him, calling for the tale of one arm's crippling, though they had heard it many times. Always, it was tales of one arm, or Alagai Ka, as they called him. Rock demons were rare in Krasia, and as Arlen complied, his audience sat entranced by the tale.
I'm afraid you will not see one arm tonight, or ever again. He has seen the sun.
Alagai Ka is dead? How did you manage this?
I will tell you the tale after tonight's victory.
Great Kaji! Spear of Everam! Grant strength to your warriors' arms and courage to their hearts this night as they go forth to your holy work!
Arlen shifted uneasily as the Damaji bestowed the blessings of Kaji, the first deliverer, on the Dal Sharam. In the north, claiming the deliverer was just a mortal man might get you in a fistfight, but it was no crime. In Krasia, such heresy was punishable by death. Kaji was Everam's messenger, come to unite all mankind against the Alagai. They called him Shardama Ka, first warrior priest, and said he would return to unite man again one day, when they were worthy of Sharak Ka, the first war. Any who suggested otherwise came to a quick and brutal end. Arlen was not such a fool as to voice his doubts about Kaji's divinity, but the holy men still unnerved him. They always seemed to be looking for an excuse to take offense at him, the outsider, and giving offense in Krasia usually meant death for the offender. But whatever discomfort Arlen might feel around the Damaji, he always swelled at the sight of Sharikhora, the enormous domed temple to Everam. Literally meaning hero's bones, Sharikhora was a reminder of what humanity was capable of, a building dwarfing any structure Arlen had ever seen. The Duke's library in Milne was tiny by comparison. But Sharikhora was impressive for more than its size. It was a symbol of courage beyond death, for it had been decorated with the bleached bones of every warrior who had died in Alagai Sharak. They ran up the support beams and framed the windows. The great altar was made entirely of skulls, the pews out of leg bones. The chalice that worshippers sipped water from was a hollowed skull resting in two skeletal hands, its stem the forearms, and its base a pair of feet. Each gigantic chandelier was made from dozens of skulls and hundreds of ribs, and the great domed ceiling, 200 feet above, was covered in the skulls of the Krasians' warrior ancestors, looking down and judging, demanding honor. Arlen once tried to calculate how many warriors decorated the hall, but the task defeated him. All the cities and hamlets in Thesia, perhaps 150,000 souls, could not have decorated a fraction of Sharikhora. The Krasians were numberless, once. Now, all of Krasia's warriors, perhaps 4,000 in all, fit into Sharikhora with room to spare. They gathered there twice each day, once at dawn and once at dusk, to honor Everam, to thank him for Korlings killed the previous night, and to beg his strength in killing them in the night to come. Most of all, though, they prayed for the Shardama Ka to come again and begin Sharak Ka. To a one, they would follow him down into the core itself. Arlen waited in the ambush pocket anxiously for the Korlings to come. The warriors around him shifted their feet. Elsewhere in the maze, Alagai Sharak had begun. They heard the reports as the mending tribe positioned on the city walls cranked and fired their weapons, launching heavy stones and giant spears into the demon ranks. Some some of them struck sand demons, killing or injuring them enough for their fellows to turn upon them. But the true purpose of the attack was to anger the Korlings, stirring them into a frenzy. Demons were easily enraged, and once so, could be herded like sheep at the sight of prey. When the Korlings were boiling, the outer gates of the city opened, disabling the outer ward net. Sand and flame demons charged through, wind demons gliding above them. Several dozen were usually allowed entrance before the gates closed and the net was re-established. Inside the gates, a group of warriors, known as Bathers, stood waiting. These men were mostly old and weak, expendable, but their honor knew no bounds. They melted at the demon's charge, splitting up in a prearranged fashion to divide the demons and lead them deeper into the maze. Watchers on top of the maze walls took down wind demons with bolas and waited next. As they crashed to the ground, stakers emerged from tiny warded alcoves to pin them before they could free themselves, shackling their limbs to warded stakes that were hammered into the ground, preventing them from returning to the core to flee the dawn. Meanwhile, the Baiters ran on, leading the sand and occasional flame demons to their doom. Arlen and the others in the pushguard tensed, hearing the shouts as their Baiters approached.
Wait! I count nine!
Nine sand demons were far more than the usual two or three that reached an ambush point.
Lights!
As the Baiters led the demons into the ambush point, the Watchers lit blazing oil fires before angled mirrors, flooding the area with light. The light could not harm them, but it gave the exhausted Baiters time to escape. Prepared for the light, they flowed with practiced precision around the demon pits, dropping into shallow warded trenches. The sand demons recovered quickly and resumed their charge, oblivious to the path the Baiters had taken. Three of them ran right onto the sand-colored tarps that covered the two wide demon pits and fell into the 20-foot hole. The traps sprung. The push guard charged from their ambush pockets, spears leveled between circular warded shields to drive the remaining Korlings into the pits. Arlen roared past his fears as he charged with the others, caught up in the beautiful madness of Krasia. His spear struck a sand and the wards flared to life, streaking silver lightning into the creature. It was swept away by the longer spears to either side of Arlen. Dazzled by the flare of defensive wards, none of the other men even noticed. Arlen's group drove the two remaining demons they faced into the open pit on their side of the ambush point. The pit's wards were a one-way kind, known only in Krasia. Korlings could enter the ring, but not escape. Under the packed soil of the pit floor lay quarried stone, cutting off their path to the core and trapping them in the pits until dawn took them. Looking up, Arlen saw the opposite side was not doing nearly so well. The tarp had snagged as it fell into their pit, leaving some of the wards covered. Before the pit warder could clear the block, the two Korlings that had fallen in climbed through the gap, killing him. The push guard on the far side of the ambush point had erupted into chaos, faced with five sand demons, and lacking a working demon pit to drive them into. There were only 10 men in that room, and the demons were in their midst.
Retreat to the pocket!
The core I will!
Arlen charged across to aid the other group. Seeing an outsider display such courage, the Dal Shaerom followed. Arlen paused only long enough to kick the tarp away from the demon pit and activate the circle. Barely missing a beat, he leapt into the melee. He stabbed the first demon in the side. And this time, the other men could not miss the flash of magic as the weapon struck home. The sand demon fell to the ground, mortally wounded, and Arlen felt a rush of wild energy flow through him. He caught movement out of the corner of his eye and pivoted, his spear in line to block the razor teeth of another sand demon. The defensive wards along the spear's length activated before the Korling could bite down, locking its mouth open. Arlen gave the spear a sharp twist and the magic flare, snapping the creature's jaw. A third demon charged, but Arlen's limbs surged with power. Arlen looked all about for another demon to fight, but the others had been driven into the pit. All about, men were staring at him in awe.
What are we waiting for? We've Alagai to hunt!
As his band scoured the maze, their numbers grew, as Arlen slew demon after demon. flushed with the thrill of victory. Arlen felt as if he had broken from a chrysalis, made anew by the ancient weapon. He felt no fatigue, though he had been running and fighting for hours. He felt no pain, though he bore many scrapes and cuts. His thoughts were focused only on the next encounter, the next demon to kill. Each time he felt the surge of magic punch through a Corling's armor, the same thought rang in his head. Every man must have one. Jardir appeared before him, and Arlen, covered in demon ichor, thrust the spear high to salute the first warrior.
Charamka! No demon will escape your maze alive tonight!
Jardir thrust his own spear into the air in response. He came and embraced Arlen like a brother.
I underestimated you, Parkin. I won't do so again.
You say that every time.
Jardir nodded to the two sand demons Arlen had just slain.
This time, for sure.
Jardir turned to the men following Arlen.
Dal Sharam!
He gestured to the dead Corlings.
Gather up these filthy things and hold them on top of the outer wall. Our sling teams need target practice. Let the Corlings beyond the wall see the folly of attacking Fort Krasia.
The men hastened to do his bidding. As they did, Jardir turned to Arlen.
The watchers report there is still battle in one of the eastern ambush points. Have you any fight left in you, Parkin?
Lead the way!
They sprinted for some time, out to one of the furthest edges of the maze.
Just ahead!
They banked around a sharp corner into an ambush point. Arlen gave no thought to the quiet, his head filled with the stomp of his feet and the pounding of his blood. But as he turned the corner, a leg shot out from the side, hooking his foot and sending him sprawling to the ground. He rolled as he struck, keeping a grip on his precious weapon. But by the time he regained his feet, men had blocked the point's only exit. Arlen looked around in confusion, seeing no signs of demons or fighting. He had found an ambush, but it was not for the Corlings.
What is this?
The Spear of Khaji belongs in the hands of the Shar Damaka. You are not he.
Arlen clutched the spear as if afraid it might fly from his hands. The men that closed on him were the same warriors he had supped with a few hours before, but there was no friendship in their eyes now. Jardir had done well in separating him from his supporters.
It doesn't have to be this way.
Arlen backed away until the demon pit at the point center was at his heels.
I can make more of these. One for every Dal Sharam. That's why I came.
We're capable of doing that ourselves. You cannot be our savior. You are only a kin.
I don't want to fight you.
Then don't, my friend. Give me the weapon. Take your horse and go with the dawn never to return.
Arlen hesitated. He had no doubt Krasia's warders could replicate the spear as well as he. In no time at all, the Krasians could turn the tide of their holy war. Thousands of lives saved, thousands of demons killed. Did it matter who took the credit? But Arlen knew this was wrong. The spear was a gift not for Krasia, but for all men. Would the Krasians share? If this scene was anything to go by, Arlen thought not.
No. I think I'll keep it a little longer. Let me make one for you, and I'll go. You'll never see me again, and you'll have what you want.
Take him!
The men closed in on Arlen.
Please! I don't want to hurt any of you! The Corlings are our enemy, not me!
Even as he protested, he exploded into motion, diverting two spear tips with a twist of his weapon, and kicking hard into the ribs of one of the men. He dove into the rush, coming up in their midst, whirling his spear like a staff, refusing to use the point. The weapon felt heavy in Arlen's hands, unlike when he fought the Corlings. Against men, it was just a spear. Arlen retreated from the responding press, putting the demon pit at his back so they could not surround him.
Again, I underestimate you, though I promised I would not.
Jardir waved, and more men came forward to add to the press. Arlen fought hard, but the outcome was never in doubt. A shaft struck the side of his head, knocking him down, and the warriors fell on him savagely, raining blows upon him until he let go of the spear to cover his head with his arms. As quickly as that, the beating stopped. Arlen was hauled to his feet, his hands pinned behind him by two thickly muscled warriors, as he watched Jardir bend over and pick up his spear. The first warrior clutched his prize tightly and looked Arlen in the eyes.
I am truly sorry, my friend. I wish there could be another way.
Everam is watching your betrayal.
Do not speak of Everam, kin. I am his Charamka, not you. Without me, Krasia falls. Who will miss you, Parkin? You will not fill so much as a single tear bottle. Throw him into the pit.
No! No!
Arlen had not recovered from the shock of impact, when Jardir's own fine spear dropped down to stick quivering in the dirt in front of him. Looking up the sheer 20-foot walls of the pit, he saw the first warrior looking down on him.
You lived with honor, Parkin, and so you may keep it in death. Die fighting, and you will awaken in paradise!
Arlen looked at the sand demon on the other side of the pit as it rose into a crouch. He rose to his feet, ignoring the pain in his bruised muscles. He reached slowly for the spear, keeping his eyes locked with the demon's. His stance, neither threatening nor fearful, confused the creature, and it paced back and forth on all fours, unsure. It wasn't easy, but it was possible to kill a sand demon with an unwarded spear. Their small, lidless eyes, normally protected by the bony ridges of their brow, went wide when they pounced. A precise thrust to that one vulnerable spot, if driven hard into the brain beyond, could kill the creature instantly. But demons healed with magical speed, and an imprecise thrust, or one that did not penetrate fully, would only enrage it further. Without a shield, in the dim light of the moon and oil lamps above, it was a nearly impossible task. While the demon puzzled out his behavior, Arlen began to slowly drag the point of the spear in the dust, scratching lines of warding directly in front of him, the Corling's most likely path. The creature would quickly find its way around, but it might buy him some time. The sand demon drifted back to the pit walls, where the shadows thrown by the lamplight above were greatest. Its tan scales blended with the clay, making it nearly invisible. Only its wide, black eyes stood out, reflecting the scant light back at him. The Corling launched itself at him, more than 100 pounds of talon, fang, and armored muscle. Arlen waited until it struck the ward. And as soon as they flared to life, he thrust hard at the exposed eyes. Arlen felt the spear point dig in, but not deeply enough before the thrust and the flare of magic threw the creature back across the pit. Arlen glanced at the spear and saw the point had broken off. He saw it glinting in the moonlight from the demon's eye as it shook off its pain and got its feet back under it. It clawed at its face and the point came free. Already the bleeding had stopped. The Corling began to slither towards him, crawling on its belly across the pit's floor. Arlen let it stalk, racing to complete a semicircle. The demon pounced again, and again the makeshift wards flared, stopping it cold. Arlen thrust again, this time attempting to drive the broken point of the spear down its maw to the more vulnerable flesh of its throat. The Corling was too quick, catching Arlen's spear in its jaws and pulling it from his grasp as it was thrown back again. Arlen's circle was far from complete, and without the spear, he had no hope of finishing it. Recovering from the blow, the sand demon was completely unprepared as Arlen leaped from behind his wards and tackled it. Arlen moved behind it to put his forearms under its armpits, locking his fingers behind its head. He drew himself up to his full height, lifting the demon from the ground. He swung the creature about, slamming it into the wall of the pit. Before it could recover from the impact, he drew back and slammed it again. His grip was weakening under the powerful creature's onslaught, so he threw his weight about one more time, hurling it into his ward. Arlen snatched up the spear and darted back behind his wards before it could recover. The enraged demon launched itself at the wards. But Arlen quickly completed a makeshift semicircle with the pit wall at his back. There were holes in the net, but he hoped they were too small for the demon to find and squeeze through. But hope failed a moment later as the Corling leapt onto the pit wall, its talons digging into the clay. It moved along the side of the wall towards Arlen, bared fangs wet with drool. Arlen's hasty wards were weak, with a short radius of protection, not much higher than the demon could jump. It wouldn't take the Corling long to realize it could climb above them. Steeling himself, Arlen placed his foot over the ward nearest the wall, cutting off its magic. He kept his foot an inch off the floor so as not to scuff the marking. He waited until the demon leapt, then stepped back, uncovering the ward. The demon was halfway across when the net reactivated. Half the creature fell into the circle with Arlen, half dropped with a thump outside. Even severed from its hindquarters, the Corling clawed and bit at Arlen as he scrambled away, keeping it back with his spear. He crossed the wards, trapping the sand demon's torso in the semicircle, still twitching as it oozed black ichor into the sand. Arlen looked up, seeing the Krasians staring at him open-mouthed. He scowled and snapped the spear over his knee. Inspired by the demon, he jabbed the broken end high into the soft clay of the pit wall. He pulled hard, his bicep bulging, and as he began to rise, he swung his other arm up, sticking the spear's broken head further up the wall. Hand over hand, Arlen climbed the 20-foot wall of the pit. As he crested the edge of the pit, the Krasians backed away, their eyes wide. His limbs like jelly, Arlen struggled to his feet. He looked at the first warrior through blurry eyes.
If you want me dead, you have to kill me yourself. There are no more Korlings left in the maze to do your work for you.
Jardir took a step forward, but hesitated at a murmur of disapproval from some of his men. Arlen had proven himself a warrior. Killing him now would not be honorable. Arlen was counting on that. But before the men had time to think it through, Jardir snapped forward, striking him on the temple with the butt of the warded spear. And just like that, Arlen knew no more. Roger danced as they walked, four brightly painted wooden balls orbiting his head. Juggling standing still was beyond him, but Roger Halfgrip had a reputation to maintain, and so he had learned to work around the limitation, moving with fluid grace to keep his crippled hand in position to catch and throw. Even at 14, he was small, barely passing 5 feet, with carrot red hair, green eyes, and a round face, fair and freckled. He ducked and stretched and turned full circles, his feet beating in tempo with the balls. His soft, split-toed boots were covered in dust from the road, and the cloud he kicked up hung around them, making every breath taste of dry soil.
Is it even worth it if you can't stay still? You look like an amateur, and your audiences won't care for breathing dirt any more than me.
Well, I won't be performing in the road.
In the hamlets, you may. There are no boardwalks there.
With no boardwalks, how do they stop demons rising inside the walls?
No walls, either. Maintaining a net around even a small hamlet would take a dozen warders. If a village has two and an apprentice, they count themselves lucky.
Roger swallowed back the taste of bile in his mouth, feeling faint. Screams, over a decade old, rang out in his head, and he stumbled, falling on his backside as balls rained down on him.
Best leave juggling to me and focus on other skills. If you spend half the time practicing singing as you do juggling, you might last 3 notes before your voice breaks.
You always said a jongleur who can't juggle is no jongleur at all.
Never mind what I said. Do you think Jason Ripping Golden Tone juggles? You've got talent. Once we build your name, you'll have apprentices to juggle for you.
Why would I want someone to do my tricks for me?
Because pretty tricks aren't where the money is, boy. Jugglers make clats. Build a name and you earn soft Milanese gold like I used to. But to build a name, you have to play the Hamlets.
Golden Tone never played the Hamlets.
Exactly my point! His uncle might be able to pull strings in Angiers, but he has no sway in the Hamlets. When we make your name, we're going to bury him.
He's no match for Sweet Song and Half Grip.
Yes!
Eric clicked his heels and danced a quick jig. Roger had deflected Eric's irritation in time. His master had become increasingly prone to fits of rage over the last few years, drinking more and more as Roger's moon waxed and his own waned. His song was no longer so sweet, and he knew it.
How far to Cricket Run?
We should be there by lunchtime tomorrow.
I thought the hamlets could only be a day apart.
The Duke's decree was that villages stand no farther apart than a man on a good horse might go in a day. A fair bit further than you get on foot.
Roger's hopes fell. Eric really meant to spend the night on the road with nothing between them and the Korlings but Gerald's old portable circle, which hadn't seen use in a decade. But Angiers was no longer entirely safe for them. As their popularity grew, Master Jason had taken a special interest in thwarting them. Being the nephew of First Minister Jansen gave him all sorts of advantages, not the least of which was the use of some of the toughs the minister kept on his payroll to deal with enemies and rivals. They broke Eric's arm the year previous, and their take had been stolen more than once after a big show. Between that and Eric's drinking and whoring, he and Roger rarely had 2 clats to click. Perhaps the Hamlets could indeed offer better fortune. Making a name in the Hamlets was a rite of passage for jongleurs and seemed a grand adventure while they were safe in Angiers. Now, Roger looked up at the sky and swallowed hard.